From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire.
We're playing the Christmas song on this June day in memory of the man who wrote it, Mel Torme. The great singer died Saturday at the age of 73. On today's Fresh Air, we'll feature an interview we recorded in 1988. Also today, we talked to Bill Murray about one of his favorite pastimes, golf. He has a new book called Cinderella Story, My Life in Golf. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews two mysteries set in the Balkans. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
Help to make the season bright. Tiny little tots with their eyes all aglow will find it hard to sleep.
First the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton spoke with Russian President Boris Yeltsin today. The two leaders agreed to do whatever they could to resolve the latest impasse in peace talks on Kosovo. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton has been making a round of phone calls to foreign leaders, trying to get the withdrawal of Yugoslavian troops underway. This weekend's talks between NATO and Yugoslav military leaders ended in failure when they failed to reach agreement on the schedule and details for a Serb pullout from Kosovo. A senior White House official said today that Yeltsin agreed to call his foreign minister, Igor Ivanov, who is meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and the other foreign ministers of the Group of Eight in Germany. Yeltsin said he would urge Ivanov to work out a U.N. resolution endorsing the Kosovo peace plan. Yugoslavia is insisting on a U.N. Security Council vote before the International Peacekeeping Force enters Kosovo. The U.S. has called for a Security Council meeting tonight, and White House officials say they're hopeful they can get a Security Council resolution soon. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
NATO continued its air campaign against Yugoslavia today after talks on a peace agreement for Kosovo collapsed overnight. Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic said he still intends to carry out the peace plan that was agreed upon last week, but the United States said Yugoslavia must demonstrate that it's really withdrawing troops before the bombing will stop. NATO warplanes attacked Yugoslav artillery positions near the Kosovo border with Albania today. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright met today with the foreign ministers of Russia and six other leading industrial powers in an effort to produce a resolution on the Kosovo crisis that could be approved by the UN Security Council. The U.S. Supreme Court has made it more difficult for prison inmates to challenge their state convictions in federal court. The justices' 6-3 ruling continues a decade-long trend in which the high court has limited the state prisoners' access to the federal courts. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The court's ruling came in the case of Darren Burkle, an Illinois man convicted of raping and beating an 87-year-old woman and sentenced to prison for 20 to 60 years. On appeal to the state Supreme Court, he raised three claims of police and prosecutorial misconduct, limiting himself to those three because of the state court's well-known disapproval of litigants raising every conceivable claim. When he lost, he appealed to the federal court, raising three additional claims. Today, however, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that because he'd not raised those claims before the Illinois Supreme Court, he'd lost the right to raise them forever in any court. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials gained 109 points to close at 10,909 in moderate trading. This is NPR News. The official results of South Africa's second democratic election show a large majority for the ruling African National Congress, but the victory falls short of a two-thirds majority in Parliament. Kate Payton reports from Johannesburg.
The ANC won so many votes that no other political party got out of single digits. The Democratic Party, led by Tony Leon, came second in the poll with 9.6% and replaces South Africa's former apartheid rulers in the new National Party as the country's official opposition. The ANC, led by Thabo Mbeki, will take 266 of the 400 seats in the National Assembly, one seat short of a two-thirds majority. The Democratic Party will have 38 seats. 12 other smaller parties will share the remaining 96. At 86%, voter turnout was much higher than expected. Thabo Mbeki will formally take over from Nelson Mandela at an inauguration ceremony on June the 16th. For NPR News, this is Kate Payton in Johannesburg.
Indonesians voted today in what are being described as the freest election in more than four decades. Voters are choosing a new parliament, which will help name a new president by the end of this year. Former President Jimmy Carter was among the outside observers called in to help monitor the elections. He said voting seemed to have been conducted fairly, with few reports of violence or complaints of voter fraud. Early returns indicated that the Indonesian Democratic Party for Struggle might be on its way to a lead in the main islands of Java and Bali. The party is run by the daughter of former Indonesian President Sukarno. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we remember Mel Torme. He died Saturday of complications from a stroke that he had in 1996. In the book Jazz Singing, Will Friedwald described Torme as working with the most beautiful voice a man is allowed to have and combining it with a flawless sense of pitch. Mel Torme was a performer for 69 of his 73 years. He made his way from child star to top-billed entertainer. Although Torme was best known for his singing, he was also an arranger, pianist, drummer, actor, and songwriter. He wrote Born to be Blue and The Christmas Song, the one that starts chestnuts roasting on an open fire. I spoke with him in 1988, after the publication of his autobiography, It Wasn't All Velvet, a reference to his nickname, The Velvet Fog. Let's start with one of his early recordings, a 1947 version of Love Me or Leave Me.
Love me or leave me, let me be lonely. You won't believe me, but I love you only. Rather be lonely than happy with somebody else. Some find the night time the right time for kissing, but night time is for just reminiscing, regretting instead of forgetting with somebody else. There'll be no one unless that someone is you. I intend to be independently blue. Today and give back tomorrow. My love is your love and yours is for somebody else. There'll be no one unless that someone is you.
Mel Torme recorded in 1947. Let's listen back to our 1988 interview.
Why don't we go back to your childhood? When you were 4 years old and when you were already starting to sing in front of audiences, Monday nights, with the Coon Sanders Nighthawk Band. Describe the atmosphere just a little bit to give us a sense of where you were at this young age.
Well, if I remember it rather vividly, believe it or not, even though I was only 4 years old, and it was redolent of that period of time. It really reeked of the late 20s, the beginning of the Depression era in the 30s. The Black Hawk was rather rococo. It was rather gaudily furnished, if I remember correctly, but in a strangely, and I know this is a contradiction in terms, a strangely tasteful way. The band sat on the stand with all those wonderful burnished horns. In those days, big bands didn't use a string bass. They used a tuba for the keeping of time along with the drums. And It was, for me, it was absolutely thrilling because as a child, I mean really as a child, I listened to the radio a great deal, particularly that band, and hearing them come through this loudspeaker with the tinkling of silverware and the murmur of the patrons, and then somebody saying, here it is, the Coon Sanders Nighthawks Orchestra, and them playing on so many of the radio shows that I listened to actually be there, and then to actually stand up on that stage and sing with that orchestra at the age of four, I'll tell you, it's Shangri-La.
Well, the band leader had asked you to sing a song because he saw you sitting very well dressed and obviously very enthusiastic about the band, and he liked your singing so much, he asked you to sit in with them every Monday night. I think that there's the possibility for it to be very damaging to a four-year-old to sing with an orchestra every week. You can be patronized, encouraged to be very cute, and to form bad habits. And I was wondering if that ever happened to you.
Absolutely not. But I don't blame myself for that. By that, I mean I don't credit myself. I credit my family. We have very, very strong fabric in this family. We're all very closely knit. The values of my mother and father were purely Midwestern, plus Jewish. They're not that they were Orthodox Jews, but they had very strong bound principles. And there's no way that little Melvin Howard Torme, and in those days it was Tormey, by the way, we added the accent many, many years later, there was no way that he was going to run amok. No possible way. So I think that even being in the business that early, if you look at the upside and the downside, it was definitely an upside for me.
You were on the road, I think, for the first time when you were about 17 with the Ben Pollock Band. And what was it like to be 17 playing with a lot of guys who were, for the most part, considerably older than you were?
It was tough. And by the way, Ben Pollock put that band together, Terry, but it was the Chico Marx band, you know, the Marx brother who played piano and used to shoot the keys when he zipped up the upper scale of the piano. It was tough. I got a lot of comeuppance, as they say in the Magnificent Ambersons, and some of it was deserved, frankly. Some of it wasn't, but I can look back now and realize that it was the natural progression of youth, you know, puberty, adolescence, and you finally get to be a young man, and then you get to be an old man if you live long enough.
A couple of years before you went on the road with that band, when you were 15 and still in high school, the Harry James Band recorded your song Lament to Love. And I'll tell you the truth, I'm not familiar with the song. Could you hum a line of it or recite or sing a chorus? Or I don't know the song.
Well, I'm not terribly good at that without a piano, but it was, Terry, a minor key song, kind of an inoffensive, and I must say rather innocuous little love song that Harry James seemed to like, and he recorded it, got on the hit parade. When you say you're not familiar with the song, don't feel too bad, Terry, because not too many people were. But it did get on the hit parade, and it stayed on the hit parade about 5 weeks in the number 7 and number 8 position out of 10 songs. And I, as a baby songwriter, I was only 15 when I wrote it and 16 when it came out, got an awful lot of press out of it.
Well, when you were playing a song for Glenn Miller, Miller said to you, don't write Moon, June, Spoon kind of lyrics. What effect did that have on you? Did that make you think more about rhymes?
Oh, absolutely. Not about rhyme. Not about rhyme. Because that's not what he was talking about. He was talking about content.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking about making pictures with lyrics. And he recommended that I listen to every lyric that Johnny Mercer had ever written. And he was absolutely right. Mercer became my role model as a songwriter and lyric writer particularly. And I began to realize that you could write something, I don't want to say profound, but redemptive in the popular song field without literally leaning on the tried and true narrow parameters of the popular song.
I want to ask you about a song that you wrote, a song you wrote early on in your career called Born to be Blue. Did you write this after Glenn Miller gave you his little lecture?
Oh, yes, yes. At least, I think it was 4 to 5 years after I spoke to Glenn Miller. And I wrote that with Bob Wells, who was my songwriting partner.
That's true, you didn't write the lyric.
Well, no, that's not true. No,
oh, okay.
No. Bob Wells and I were a team in the purest sense of the word because Bob was extremely musical as well as an extremely fine lyric writer. And I was purely a lyric writer as well, hopefully, as a composer of popular type song music. So when we worked together, even on the Christmas song and Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire, he contributed to the melody, I contributed a lot of the lyrics. And that's the way we worked.
Let me play a recording that you made of your song Born to Be Blue in the mid-40s with Sonny Burke and his orchestra. And let's listen to a little of Mel Torme singing his own song, Born to Be Blue.
¶¶ folks were meant to live in clover. But they are such a chosen few, and clover being green is something I've never seen, 'cause I was born to be blue. When there's a yellow moon above me, they say there's moonbeams I should view, but moonbeams being gold are something I can't behold, 'cause I was born to be blue.
Mel Torme's 1946 recording of Born to be Blue. We'll hear more of our 1988 interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1988 interview with Mel Torme. He died on Saturday. Let's get back to the mid-1940s, around the time that the recording we just heard was made. You sang at the Copa in New York at that time. And this was a turning point for you in a way, kind of a bad experience. You'd gotten this big build-up as the Velvet Fog, which you were nicknamed by one of the New York DJs. And you thought that build-up really worked against you in performance.
I'm not so sure about performance, Terry, but I think it did work against me from the standpoint of the fact that I was sort of shoved down the New York collective throat. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of course, the critics, the people in the press media, the print media, they all said basically to the disc jockeys, quit inundating the airwaves with this guy and telling us that he's the greatest thing since chopped liver. We'd like to discover that for ourselves, not have you. There was great rivalry, particularly in those days, between the power of the so-called disc jockey and the press. Who was more influential? And I was kind of caught in the nutcracker.
You were also kind of caught in the middle of two generations, too, weren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I came onto the Copa stage at a time when the Copa was playing nobody except the considerably older performers, the Sophie Tuckers, the, you know, Joey Lewis's, Jimmy Durante. Those were the staples at the Copa. Now, here comes this squirt from California, and he's going to entertain us? Come on. And consequently, I really got my lumps at the Copa, some of which, again, I deserved.
Well, you said you had to sing in a falsetto then, and listening to your records from the mid-40s, I don't hear what you mean.
No. I don't know where that came from, but I don't even know how to sing falsetto. As a matter of fact, you know, my range in the last several years has increased on the upper end as well as the lower end by at least three or four, maybe five notes. And when I sing very high notes in some of the records that I've made with George Shearing and even on my own, some absolutely ill-informed critics say he even sounds good in falsetto. I can't produce. I don't know how to produce a falsetto note. What those notes are what singing teachers call covered tones. They're done up in the head, but they are absolutely pure. They have nothing to do with mechanical or ersatz formation of notes. I didn't sing in a falsetto way in those days, Terry, but I did sing in rather a wispy, kind of creamy, and I felt rather callow way. And consequently, I couldn't bear to hear the sound of my voice on records in those days. Not that I'm that wild about it today, but at least now I can tolerate, because of the aging process, because my voice has deepened, and because I think I've learned a little more about singing than I knew back in 1947 at the Copa, I can tolerate what I record on record.
Well, I'm afraid I don't really understand why you couldn't tolerate what you did before.
I think it's very much like talking to some of the actors, for instance, that I'm sure you've spoken to from time to time, and they say, oh, boy, that early movie of mine, oh, please, cut it up and make it into banjo picks. I think I always look back upon my early work, and as a matter of fact, when I look back upon last week and say, what could I have done better? That's what I'm looking at when I look at the early things, and I just felt that they were just a little too juvenile sounding, a little too young sounding to please me, certainly at this point in my life.
Well, you said that you used to sing in a head tone, and now you're singing with your diaphragm.
Right.
What's the difference between the two, and how did you start to change?
I think you mainly produce head tones, obviously, in the head. Breathing, of course, is everything in singing. But I taught myself to breathe from the diaphragm. And I can produce notes now that are very powerful. I'm a far, far more robust singer than I used to be in those days. And that is more pleasing to my personal ear. Beyond that, as I say, I taught myself my own sort of breathing exercise to the point where I can hold a note, for instance, at the end of a song almost interminably. And I think that's terribly important that you're able to control your breathing, particularly for phrasing of lyrics.
Well, here's what I want to do. I want to play a record you made in 1956 of Nice Work If You Can Get It, the Gershwin song. I don't know what you think about this recording, but we're about to find out. and I should mention, as you probably know, that this was singled out by the people who did the American Popular Song Anthology for the Smithsonian Collection of Recordings. And this is a collection of some of the greatest American popular songs. And they did their attempt to find the definitive recordings of these great songs. And so your recording of Nice Work If You Can Get It was chosen. So let's give this a spin and then see what you think of it.
Okay.
Holding hands at midnight, 'neath the starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Strolling with the one girl, sighing sigh after sigh. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Just imagine someone waiting at the cottage door, where two hearts become one. Who could ask for anything more? Loving one who loves you, and then taking that vow. Nice work if you can get it, and if you get it, won't you tell me how?
It's Mel Torme as recorded in 1956. So what do you think?
Not bad.
Yeah, I concur. I wasn't
that terrible. No, actually, it sounds pretty good. I was sort of hit and miss in those days because I was still earning my wings. My whole career, as I point out in this book of mine, is a work in progress. The learning curve is always there. Whitney Balliot did a big profile on me in the New Yorker magazine about 4 or 5 years ago. And when he asked me why all this wonderful stuff is happening for me right now, this tremendous renaissance of my career and everything, I looked him right in the eye and said, Whitney, I'm learning how to sing. And he really gave me a look that said, my God, what an ingenuous remark. I said, no, Whitney, don't look at me that way. I'm telling you, point blank, I am learning how to sing. I do that, Terry, literally every day of my life. And that's not a phony modesty remark. I am, I think, on a daily basis, learning a little more about myself, learning how to be more consistent, how to concentrate more on what I sing. And I hope that's to the good.
Mel Torme, recorded in 1988. He died Saturday at the age of 73. Here's Torme, recorded in 1957. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
A cigarette that bears a lipstick's traces, an airline ticket to romantic places,
a fairground's painted swings, these foolish things remind me of you. A tinkling piano in the next apartment, those stumbling words that told you what my heart meant, and yet my heart has wings, these foolish things remind me.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, publisher of O Jerusalem by Laurie R. King, the fifth book in the Holmes Russell series, available in hardcover nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up after Bill Murray on his days as a golf caddy, his new book is called Cinderella Story, My Life in Golf. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews two mysteries set in the Balkans, one old and one new. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Golf is considered one of the most quiet, reflective, and polite sports, except when actor and comic Bill Murray is on the golf course. He became famous in the golf world for his shenanigans playing on the Pro-Am golf circuit, which brings together pros and celebrities. He literally tore up the golf course in his movie Caddyshack, in which he played the groundskeeper of the course. Murray used to caddy as a kid. Now he has a new book called Cinderella Story, My Life in Golf. The title refers to his monologue from Caddyshack. In this scene from Caddyshack, he's providing his own color commentary as if he's competing in the Masters, but instead of a golf club, he has a sickle, and what he's swinging at is chrysanthemums.
The crowd is standing on its feet here at Augusta, the normally reserved Augusta crowd, going wild. For this young Cinderella, who's come out of nowhere, he's got about 350 yards left. He's going to hit about a 5-iron, I expect, don't you think? He's got a beautiful backswing. He got all of that one. He's got to be pleased with that. The crowd is just on its feet here. He's a Cinderella boy. Tears in his eyes, I guess, as he lines up this last shot. He's got about 195 yards left, and looks like he's got about an 8-iron. This crowd has gone deadly silent. Cinderella story, out of nowhere. Former greenskeeper, now about to become the Masters champion. It looks like I'm a wreck. It's in the hole! It's in the hole!
Hey, young fellow, I was hoping to squeeze in 9 holes before this rain starts.
Certainly, Your Eminency.
Take my bag, huh?
Certainly, Your Magnificence.
Okay, come on, chomp chomp.
So how old were you when you started working at golf clubs?
10.
And what was your first job?
I was a shag boy.
What does that mean?
It's not an Austin Powers thing.
Yeah, it sounds kind of dirty, doesn't it?
Yeah, you would drop a bag of golf balls on a practice tee, and then you just run out into somewhere out there. And the player would practice and hit the balls, and you had to fetch them like a dog out there. And sometimes they'd go for a half an hour, sometimes they'd go for an hour, sometimes they'd go for an hour and a half. And when he hit all the balls, you ran back in, dropped them in front of him, and ran back out. It was Cocker Spaniel work, but you were outside, and as long as you didn't drift off and get, you know, your mind, you could get hit, you know, your mind could wander. I started doing it like it was, like I was playing the outfield or the infield or something. I'd try to retrieve them all before they stopped moving, you know. I'd get the break, I'd get the Mickey Mantle jump on it and go for it. And so that kept me amused for a while. But
I think your brothers were already working at the golf club when you started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my oldest brother, Edward, started there, and he really was slavishly devoted to golf. He got into it very seriously, and he still is, and now his children are. He worked his way through the caddying ranks till he worked in the pro shop, and then he got a caddy scholarship to go to college. My other brother, Brian, he worked his way as a caddy until he earned enough money to buy cigarettes, and then he worked on playing cards and perfecting his cursing. But they both turned out okay, considering. But so I was Little Murray, I guess, when I showed up.
And how old were you when you were big enough to start caddying?
I think I was 11 and a half when I finally got a caddy, like 12. But I mean, I carried singles until I was 13, which means you carried one bag. And then when I was 13, I started carrying doubles. And then so you carried two bags, and then you get paid twice as much, which wasn't very much. And you have to take care of two people while you play.
You were a greenskeeper in the movie Caddyshack. And in Caddyshack, it was part of your assignment to kill the gophers that were tearing up the green on the golf course. Did you ever have to do that, worry about gophers?
Well, they needed me on that wall, Terry. I didn't have to do it ever, but I was there once when it was done. There were gophers that were burrowing into the side of a green. And I wasn't there when it happened, but they had put poison into their warren or whatever it is. And we were there to see these little baby gophers stumble out, you know, for their last sunrise. It was, you know, not, I mean, I didn't fall apart or anything, but it was, you know, you don't want to see anything die. And little baby gophers, that was kind of tough. But yeah, so that's my, that was, you know, that was method acting, if that's what your question was.
Yes.
I've done that before, and I was calling upon that.
The emotional memory.
Mm-hmm.
In Caddyshack, your most famous scene is the scene when you're basically doing your own color commentary for yourself. You're the greenskeeper imagining yourself a big golf pro star. What kind of feedback do you get from golfers about that movie and particularly that scene?
Well, everybody's done it. I mean, a lot of the things I've done in that film are things that every kid has done while talking himself through his own practice time or his own playing alone time. You know, you hear players say, when they make a great shot or a great play at the end of a game, they say, well, I've done that 1,000 times practicing. Well, you know, and they narrated it, too, at the same time. You know, but people, there's something about the movie Caddyshack that touches people. And when I look at it now, I watched it the other night, and it's hard to turn off or walk away from when it starts because it's engaging. And there aren't many movies about golf, and it fills that niche. And it's also, it's some sort of movie about class or status or something, you know. So it has a Prince and the Pauper feel, something like that. And so it appeals to people at that level because, you know, when you talk about golf being a certain kind of person's game, certainly one of the gripes is that it's a rich person's game, you know.
Now, I think that Caddyshack was written, or at least co-written, by your brother Brian Doyle Murray.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any in-jokes from your years together working on the golf course that ended up in the movie?
Well, sure. There was there's various people that are portrayed in the movie that are the actual names of the people we used to caddy for. Like Mr. and Mrs. Haverkamp was this deadly pair of 36 handicap golfers, which is the legal limit. You can't get higher than 36 for a man and 40 for a woman, and they were that. And they had matching gray bags, and, you know, when you'd be given your loop, as it was called, your job, it was sort of like a trucker bringing out whatever truck he's driving this morning or something, and you'd come out of the pro shop carrying these identical gray bags, and the caddies would just go wild because you had the Haverkamps. And you had what was basically a day's job getting them around the course. You know, they're very nice people, but a terrifying game. You could never try to walk ahead of them because the ball could go in any direction. And it was just going to take you all day to finish 18 holes.
Bill Murray is my guest, and he's written a new book called Cinderella Story, My Life in Golf. Now, I understand you're going to be in the new movie The Cradle Will Rock.
Yes, I've already done it.
You've already done it. Mm-hmm. Is that based on the Mark Blitzstein musical, or is it about the kind of actors who were in the musical?
Both. It takes place and it climaxes the night of the opening of the Blitzstein musical.
Oh, so it's about the making of the musical.
Right. It's just, I'm told that it was at the Cannes Festival the other night, and it got the longest standing ovation any film's ever had gotten. Then I read the paper today that didn't win anything. So I don't know what. Maybe it wasn't in competition. Maybe it was just being shown.
So tell us a little bit about the story and who you play in it.
Well, I'm a creation of the writer, Tim Robbins, who is also the director. I play a ventriloquist whose job in the Federal Theater Project, which is the time period that we're talking about, is to teach the next generation of ventriloquists. And since their vaudeville is dying rapidly at that moment, dying very quickly at that time, there's not really going to be any place for these ventriloquists to go anyway. But I've got some ventriloquists, or guys that want to be ventriloquists, that don't understand that your mouth can't move when you're talking, you know. So I'm having a lot of trouble. And I'm basically kind of a cranky old vaudevillian ventriloquist.
Did you have to learn ventriloquism for the role?
Well, I learned some. Yeah, I got so I was okay at it. I mean, it's... And it occurred to me that if I wanted to do it, I could do it, you know. But you just have to practice and practice and practice. I got so I was pretty good at it, and I got so that the voice was all right, and I could not move my lips, and I learned some of the tricks about it. I mean, the comedy of it is harder than anything, I think, but the business of it is just really a matter of technique and just practicing over and over.
This really shows, in a way, how show business has changed. When I was growing up in the 50s, a lot of the old vaudevillians were still on the variety shows, like the Ed Sullivan Show. Mm-hmm. And there were ventriloquists even, like, on the Howdy Doody Show. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as a kid, I mean, I guess everybody tried to figure out, oh, can I do that? Can I, you know, speak without my lips moving? And I don't think kids today watching TV would feel compelled to learn ventriloquism. You wouldn't see a ventriloquist, I don't think.
Well, you'd think it's just a special effect.
That's true, you would.
You would think that it was re-recorded. I mean, there are commercials where they do ventriloquism and they do spectacular, unbelievable things, so you wouldn't think anything of it unless you saw it live.
But, you know, I'm wondering if you grew up with the other vaudeville things. I was watching a rerun of the Mickey Mouse Club the other night. Mm-hmm. So here's all these kids in the 50s, and, like, for the talent roundup song, they're doing this, like, tap dance and just doing all these really vaudevillian kinds of moves that have nothing to do with their generation. But the generation of showbiz people working with them were bringing in all of their generation stuff. And it was just fascinating to watch this totally out-of-date performance style being done by kids.
Well, it's cruel. Yeah, it is cruel. I mean, there are some people that think line dancing is cruel, to teach that to children, you know?
what do you mean,
my boy was doing the electric slide last night, you know?
But did you grow up watching a kind of generation of performers that were going to be just incredibly outdated by the time you grew up, but you were trying to emulate them?
Well, I saw the Mickey Mouse Club, and I remember Doreen and all those babes doing crazy kinds of dance routines that were nutty, you know, and I think one of them graduated to the Lawrence Welk show and ended up dancing on that show. But they did all kinds of things, and you thought, gosh, if only I could be a Mouseketeer, but I wouldn't want to do what he does, or I wouldn't want to do what she does. It seemed like they were overqualified for jobs that weren't going to exist when they became adults. So you're absolutely right. But I don't know what you would do if you were trying to train somebody now. I mean, it's like watching, you know, pageant kids or something. What are they practicing for? I don't know. What are they trying to figure out here? I don't know what they're trying to learn. I highly recommend tap dancing. Tap dancing is really a lot of fun.
Did you learn it? It's fun to do.
Well, there was one time when we had this gigantic cast at the Second City in Chicago where everybody was over 6 feet. We were called the Seven Giant Goyim or something like that. We were these big giants. We decided to do a tap dance number because we thought it would be the most frightening thing to be on this stage and just come down stage and tap on our wooden stage, because it would be like a Gatling gun right in front of the audience, and we would sort of overpower them. And we took tap dancing lessons for about 6 weeks, but nothing ever came of it. But it just makes you laugh doing the steps. You just start laughing a lot. And you sweat a lot too. It's quite a workout. I think that Tai Bo guy is probably going to like have a tap dance. Somebody should have a tap dance video infomercial, and they could do well with it. But it's that's the only thing I know how to do. I mean, I can sing, and my few tap dancing steps I do repeatedly over and over again, just like I can play just a few notes on the piano. And when I walk through a room, I play those notes, you know, the Rhapsody in Blue, and then I walk away like, and I always like act like the piano's out of tune, and then walk away, and people go, oh no, go on, please, no.
My guest is Bill Murray. His new book is called Cinderella Story, My Life in Golf. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Murray, the star of such films as Rushmore, Kingpin, and Groundhog Day. In his days on Saturday Night Live, he was famous for his merciless imitations of bad lounge singers. When we left off, we were talking about the generation gap in entertainment and some of the old-fashioned and often bad performers he used to watch on TV when he was a kid. I figured the inspiration for his character, Nick the Lounge Singer, must have come in part from watching bad singers on TV. I think one of the alienating things about hearing some of the songs sung when I was a kid is that they were sung by singers on the Ed Sullivan Show with sequin gowns and big phony smiles on their faces, belting it out, just really ruining some great songs.
Well, it was a different generation of song ruiners, I guess. They ruined them differently in those days.
That's right. But you must have loved that stuff in a good, bad way because, I mean, you can mock it so well.
Well, you have to, I guess, I enjoy mocking it, but you have to see where the original center of it was and how they destroy it, you know. It's the ruining of the good song that you want to recreate, you know. It's not the song itself is as good or bad as it is, but it's even sometimes the original singer of the song doesn't sing it as well, you know. Sometimes his version of the song is the worst version, you know. He just got it first, but you have to like the stuff, and you have to, know that when you have the song and you have the microphone, you have the opportunity to touch somebody. And when you don't do it with the lyric or the power of it, but you do it with your own excuse for technique comes in and steps on top of it. That's what I guess what I object to and what I want to. I want to mimic.
You've really studied that so well.
Well, I'm a good listener, I guess, and I always think when you have the opportunity. Of course, I'm very much aware of it now. I have an opportunity to say something. What am I saying? I'm saying, well, I like to watch bad entertainers, and I get a kick out of imitating them. But you know, bad entertainment gets jammed down your throat all the time. You know, it's forced down your throat. And like you talk about the Sullivan Show, there was this case where it was the biggest show in America. It was on once a week, and people fought like dogs for that spot on the show. And they, you know, when they got their spot, they went out there, you know, with all the energy they possibly could have, and just blasted themselves, you know, through the screen at people, you know, sometimes losing control, I think, and. You know, you can see where that the just the desire for success, or the fear space that you could get into backstage at the Sullivan would make you mad. I had the occasion to play Carnegie Hall. I actually got to sing at Carnegie Hall last month, and as part of a benefit for the a rainforest thing, I was asked to do it because it was a Sinatra theme, and they couldn't find anybody to do My Way, and they felt it was important to have My Way in the show. So I got the call like 2 days before, and I thought, am I going to really do this thing with these guys? These are real singers going to be, you know, it's like Tony Bennett, Elton John, you know, Sting, Don Henley. These guys can actually show up. And then I thought, well, hell, when's the last time anybody asked me to sing at Carnegie Hall? So I did it. but the anxiety I felt backstage. I mean, I thought I'd swallowed a goose. I mean, I there was just nothing between my solar plexus and my throat for about 13 minutes before I went on stage. I just didn't think I was going to make it. But it all turned out okay. It had a happy ending. But boy, just the anxiety of having to go out there. I never had anything quite like that, of feeling, oh my God, am I in over my head this time?
So what did you do with the song?
I murdered it. I absolutely killed it. I went out. It was like two-thirds of the way through the show. It was after the intermission, and I went out, no introduction, you know, in the dark. And I had this full orchestra behind me. And I couldn't talk, my dry mouth, you know, bad bladder, everything going wrong all at once, falling apart. And then when I hit the stage, I just sort of... I sort of channeled Frank, I guess. I don't know. All of a sudden it just happened, you know. I just started becoming the guy, and they start playing that music for My Way. And, you know, with a full orchestra, you know, we could all pull it off almost, you know. I mean, it gives you a lot of backing. And I started singing the notes, and I can sing. So people later said, we thought you were lip syncing because it was so good, Terry. It was that good. But I started lip syncing, and then I basically rewrote the lyrics and changed them around to suit my own mood. And I started getting laughs with it. And then I was off the click track. I mean, there's a full orchestra playing to its own chart, so they just keep playing, you know. And the fact that I'm I'm off the lyric and talking and doing things, they don't, it doesn't matter to them. They don't keep vamping. Like, it's not like a piano bar. They just keep going to the end. So I said to the audience, I said, let's see if this big band's going to stay with me here. And they didn't. They just kept barreling right ahead. But I managed to catch them at the pass. I headed them off at the pass and turned it around and got out of it at the end. And it was huge. It was a big deal.
What were your lyrics?
Oh, I can't remember. But I said, I don't know. I just changed them. I changed everything, yeah. There were elegant dames. I'm, you know, stuff like that. You know, just to, hey, Jack, you know, a lot of that, and yelling at the band. Hey, louder! You know, stuff like that. And some of these chicks were a bit more than I could, you know, that, you know, anything. So I had a lot of fun doing it. It was really fun.
Bill Murray, his new book is called Cinderella Story, My Life in Golf. Coming up, two mysteries set in the Balkans. This is Fresh Air. We've been reading about war in the Balkans in the front pages of the newspapers. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of two mystery novels set in the region, one old, one new. She says this is a region of the world that outsiders have often found to be a mystery unto itself.
Shadowy, corrupt, chaotic, a place where borders and allegiances always seem to be shifting. That's the image of the Balkans painted by even the soberest of our news correspondents. How many of them, I wonder, are Eric Ambler fans who may have received their first indelible, sinister impression of the Balkans from Ambler's 1939 thriller masterpiece, A Coffin for Demetrius? This idea that fiction influences our perception of reality is at the heart of the plot of A Coffin for Demetrius itself. The novel's unwitting hero is Charles Latimer, an economic historian turned detective fiction writer. Traveling around Europe, Latimer meets the head of the Turkish secret police, who tells him a story about a Greek master criminal named Demetrius, whose drowned corpse has just been recovered. Latimer gets sucked in by the literary potential of Demetrius's story and begins to act the detective himself, investigating Demetrius's notorious career. Snooping his way through the menacing back alleys of the Balkans, as well as Paris and Geneva, Latimer discovers that Demetrius made a fortune in pimping, blackmail, assassination, the white slave trade, and drug smuggling. Of course, a master criminal like Demetrius doesn't die easily. And long before the lumbering Latimer catches on, we readers suspect that Demetrius is alive and irritated by the investigation. The final confrontation between Demetrius and Latimer is a triumph of the macabre. A Coffin for Demetrius was Ambler's fifth novel, published in the same week that World War II broke out in Europe. Ambler had already distinguished himself as a writer bent on elevating suspense fiction out of the schlock pile. In his 1985 autobiography, he dryly noted that, as I saw it, the thriller had nowhere to go but up. Ambler's leftist politics were markedly different from his conservative suspense writer predecessors, like John Buchan. In A Coffin for Demetrius, the polyglot international conspiracy of criminals that Demetrius heads represents for Ambler a miniaturized version of modern society corrupted by capitalism. Ambler also tried to root his novels in real-life political situations. Here's one of his characters sagely commenting on the way fictions can be used to fuel old nationalist hatreds. For the past 3 months, there has been a stream of propaganda to the effect that Yugoslavia is planning to attack Bulgaria. Such propaganda always begins with words, but soon it proceeds to deeds. Where there are no facts to support lies, facts must be made. One foreign correspondent who must have read Ambler and certainly carries on his literary tradition is Dan Fesperman, who reported on the Balkans for the Baltimore Sun. Fesperman has just published a brilliant thriller set in contemporary Sarajevo called Lie in the Dark. Detective Inspector Vlado Petric is one of two homicide detectives left in the city. His situation is absurd, given that corpses are commonplace on the streets of Sarajevo. But Petric stays on the job, sustained by the belief that, now and then, one murder offered a portal to machinations far greater than the pulling of a trigger or the plunging of a blade. When he stumbles upon the body of the chief of special police, Petric finds that portal to something larger, an art smuggling scheme that stretches back to World War II. Fesperman's novel, like all superior detective fiction, offers keen social commentary along with its suspense. Following Petric, we enter apartments heated only by jerry-rigged gas jets, drink diluted Nescafe, traverse the city on foot because there's no alternative, and cast a cold eye both on refugees from the countryside and those visiting flak-jacketed celebrities who climbed upon the ruins of Sarajevo's misery for a few brief moments in the world's spotlight, then departed once the lights were off. In Raymond Chandler's immortal phrase, mystery fiction investigates a world gone wrong. Some 60 years apart, both Eric Ambler and Dan Fesperman have located the ground zero of that world in the Balkans.
Maureen Carrigan recently won a 1999 Edgar Mystery Award. She reviewed A Coffin for Demetrius by Eric Ambler and Lie in the Dark by Dan Fesperman. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Schirach. Our engineer was Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, call 877-21-FRESH. That's 877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Little Brown & Company, publisher of The Majors, In Pursuit of Golf's Holy Grail.